And I was trying to determine exactly what I wanted to do with this. I know there are several visitors here or people who are normal members here that weren't here a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't know if I wanted to, start as if nothing had ever happened and have the people that were here, smiling under their breath or whatever, or say something like this, and all the visitors are scratching their heads going, what on earth is he talking about? And meanwhile, I go to the Panhandle and the Ingles show up and hear the whole thing up there, and it's just a little bit of a different sort of situation. But we're going back and talking about this question of whether the Bible is trustworthy. If you remember several weeks ago, a couple months ago now probably, I did a study of the reliability of the New Testament, and it was kind of a very big, broad look at every different sort of evidence, very briefly sort of study. And one of them was this question of the trustworthiness of the authors and their accuracy as reporting the story, and whether or not we can look at these books and trust them to give us the true story of what actually happened back in the first century. And we kind of went through that very quickly, and I wanted to come back and talk about it some more in more detail and investigate more of that evidence. So that's what we're doing this evening. We're going back to this question of the accuracy of the gospel authors in particular. In particular, of course, Acts would go in with that as well, since it's authored by Luke. And it's really a study about the Bible more than it is a study of the biblical text, but it's a valuable study, I think, because this is one of the chief battlegrounds that we face as Christians, because skeptics today aren't the same as skeptics have been in the past. Skeptics argue from different sorts of perspectives, and there were times where people said, well, you can't believe in miracles, or there were times where people said, well, Jesus didn't really die on the cross, he merely fainted on the cross and then resuscitated in the tomb. And people don't make those kinds of arguments as much anymore as they used to. Now they attack the accuracy of the Gospels, or the accuracy of the transmission of those Gospels over the years, or those kinds of things. And so the question is whether or not we can trust the biblical account. And we saw this quote a couple of weeks ago, and I'll show it to you again. It's a lengthy quote. There are a couple of lengthy quotes tonight. Bear with me in that if you would. This is a familiar idea. If you're not familiar with the quote, it's known as C.S. Lewis' trilemma. What Lewis says is, I'm trying here to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus, is who he's speaking of, about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of thing that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of the man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Now, if you're not familiar with the whole quote, you've probably heard at some point in your life someone say, Jesus is either a Lord, liar, or lunatic. He must be one of these three things. And Lewis is the one who really made this argument popular. It was around before him. And it's really sort of a common sense argument. What it says is the sorts of claims that Jesus made about himself are so demanding that when you examine the fact that he's either right or he's wrong, it leaves you with just these three options. If he's right about the claims that he made, then he's Lord. If he's wrong about them, then you have to ask the question, did he know he was wrong or did he not know he was wrong? If he was wrong and he knew he was wrong and he kept saying it, that makes him a liar. If he was wrong but he didn't know that he was wrong, he thought he was really the Son of God, that makes him a lunatic. And it's a very powerful argument, except for the skeptic, especially the modern brand of skeptic who says, no, those are not the only three options. There's a fourth option, and it's that Jesus was merely legend. Jesus never really existed. Or if he did exist, he didn't exist as the Gospels portray him. That these are legendary stories that changed over time. You can't trust them to be accurate representations of the historical Jesus. And so that's the question again. Can we trust the Gospel accounts? Well, what do you see when you examine the accuracy of the authors. And you can examine it from a variety of perspectives. One of the things that I think is most powerful is just how accurate they are when you integrate the Gospels into the Greco-Roman world. If you look at all of the places where the Greco-Roman world, the history that we have available to us, the archaeology that we have available to us, all of the things that we know for sure about first century Greco-Roman world, and all the places that intersects with the Gospel stories and the stories of Acts, just how accurate they are. We left off last time talking about William Ramsey, who was an archaeologist of the 19th century, who was a very very influential, very preeminent, predominant archaeologist. He was like the class of archaeologists of his day. And what's so amazing about him and the testimony that he offers to the accuracy of Luke and Acts, and particularly he's talking about Acts, is that he was not a believer. He's not someone who went into his study predisposed to believe what he ended up believing. He was a skeptic. He didn't believe that Acts was actually written by Luke, the historical Luke. He believed that it was written 100 years later by someone who was putting Luke's name on it. And he went into his study not thinking that he would find anything reliable from the book of Acts about the culture of Asia Minor. And so he goes into the study of the history and geography of Asia Minor, presuming Acts to be unreliable. And this is the end of the long quote, so bear with me one more time. Ramsey says in his book, St. Paul, the Traveler and Roman Citizen, "I may fairly claim to have entered on this investigation without prejudice in favor of the conclusion, which I shall now seek to justify to the reader. On the contrary, I began with a mind unfavorable to it. It did not then lie in my line of life to investigate the subject minutely, but more recently I found myself brought into contact with the book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In fact, beginning with the fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition, and never relying on its evidence as a trustworthy for first century conditions, I gradually came to find it a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations." So what Ramsey's saying is he's not a believer. He doesn't believe Acts was written by Luke. He believes it was written in the second century. He didn't think it was going to be reliable at all. And as he studied the archaeology, the geography, the history of Asia Minor, what he found is that Luke was extremely reliable in his writing of the book of Acts. And not only was it reliable, it was an authority for the topography and antiquities and society of Asia Minor. That he got to the point where if he found himself in a jam in terms of understanding something, instead of looking at Acts and saying, "I can't trust this," he looked at Acts as assistance for helping him understand it. That's how reliable he found it to be. Ramsey goes on to say, "Luke's history is unsurpassed in respect to its trustworthiness." In another writing, he says, "Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements trustworthy, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians." And again, what's so powerful about his testimony of the accuracy of Luke as an author of the book of Acts is he goes into this unbelieving. I mean, if you have like the most prominent Christian believer doing this study, and he walks away writing these things down, that doesn't have the same force. But someone going into this with a fixed idea that it is not reliable and walking away with this conclusion, that's powerful as to just how accurate Luke was. And Ramsey's not the last person to do this. A later scholar, now deceased by the name of Colin Hemer, wrote a book called The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History, where he kind of updates all of this and goes further into this study. And what he does is he lists 84 specific facts from the last 16 chapters of the book of Acts that have been confirmed by historical and archaeological research. And what's amazing about these are the kinds of facts that he talks about. You know, he doesn't include in this, you know, Luke says that Rome was the capital of the Roman Empire. Oh boy, that's amazing. Luke knew that. Well, everybody knows that. You don't have to have been anyone with any kind of knowledge to know that. The kinds of things that Hemer talks about are ports, boundaries, landmarks, slang terminology, local languages, local deities, local industries, proper titles for regional and local officials. These are the kinds of things that were not the same from one city to the next. They're not the same from one decade to the next, necessarily. And Luke gets all of them right all the way through his narrative. I mean, you think in our terms, in particular, you think of something like slang terminology and just how quickly slang terminology changes. The example I like to use is the word bad. And how many different things has the word bad meant in the last 20 years? And what are the odds that if you're reading a document, whether it's a published professional document or a letter that a friend wrote to another friend, using the word bad several times, and you're not acquainted with that use, say, you know, you're a German from 100 years from now, and you're able to read English and you're reading that, what sense is that going to make to you? Probably not a whole lot. What are the odds that if you're the German and you want to write something and pretend that it's accurate, that you could properly use it all the way through? Slang terminology changes so quickly. For it to be used accurately throughout the book of Acts is an amazing thing. Things like the proper titles for regional and local officials. For example, Luke gets right the governor of Cyprus, the magistrates in Philippi, the officials in Thessalonica, the chief executive magistrate in Ephesus, and the ruler of Malta, all of which use different titles in their own region. Things were very different. I mean, it's not like every one of these people was called mayor, and Luke got them all right. It's not a homogenized kind of culture. All of them had a different title specific to that city, and Luke knew every single one, and he had every single one of them accurate, including at least one that for years skeptics said he got wrong until there was archaeological proof that showed that he was right. And so it widely diverse geographic area, using different titles, Luke gets all of them right. It's all been confirmed by inscriptional evidence or by other authors that use the same title in particular. Really what the skeptic's argument against the accuracy of the authors boils down to is an argument from silence. And if you're familiar with arguments from silence, you know that they are across the board invariably terrible arguments. What an argument from silence basically says is, well, we don't have any data one way or the other, so the author must be wrong. That's something of an oversimplification, but that's basically what it boils down to. One of the very famous arguments from silence that was made from the Old Testament, and I'll use this as an example to kind of let you know the sort of thing that I'm talking about, is the character Belshazzar in the story of Daniel. For years, Belshazzar was laughed at by the skeptical scholars because there was no Belshazzar in any record anywhere of Babylonian time. And here we have this biblical story saying he's the last king, he sees his handwriting on the wall, and the empire falls while he's the king. But we know, the skeptics say, that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon, not this Belshazzar fellow. Well, what we find as time rolls on is, well, Nabonidus was the last king, but he was a little kooky. And when he was out of town, which he was very often, he left his son in charge. You know what his son's name was? Belshazzar. We found that out later on. And that makes perfect sense in the biblical story as well, because what does Belshazzar offer the person who can interpret the handwriting on the wall? Third place in the kingdom. Why doesn't he offer him second place in the kingdom? Because he is second place in the kingdom. So the highest thing he could offer was third. But you see, the skeptical argument was, we don't know anything about this person, so the biblical author must be wrong. There's no evidence whatsoever about this person or about this thing, so the biblical author must be wrong. And that's what it boils down to all the time for the skeptic, is if there is no evidence anywhere else, if it's never mentioned in any other writing, if nothing has ever been dug up about it, then the Bible must be wrong. And you see easily just the problems with that kind of argument. One, it is so excessively skeptical that it's absurd. How can anyone go to any document and presume that's the case about that document? It must be wrong all the time is basically what it boils down to. Have you ever read any document with that presumption? I mean, I don't even think I would pick up a religious document that I completely disagree with and presume that it's wrong about everything all the time. Yet that's what skeptics are basically saying about the Bible. If it can't be confirmed, then it must be wrong. On top of that, it presumes that we have enough information about the ancient past to make a legitimate judgment about that. We know for a fact from book lists from the second century that we have lost to time some 85% of writings from the 2nd century AD, just from the book lists. They're gone. We don't know a thing about them except the titles. That's the 2nd century AD. How much did we lose before that? Or how much was written that wasn't on that list that we don't know about? The reality is, the ravages of time are just such that we can't hope that there's confirmation for everything. What we have by way of faith building as Christians is confirmation of enough. If so many things are confirmed over and over and over, then doesn't it make sense to believe the Bible's right in those other places as well? Well, here are a few examples of places where skeptics have made an argument from silence in the New Testament. I'll run through them very quickly. I don't want to get too bogged down in this. In Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, there's a fellow by the name of Lysanias who is listed as a tetrarch of Abilene. But the skeptics said for years that, no, that's wrong, and that shows that Luke didn't know what he was talking about, and it was written a century later, and he's trying to sound right. There was a fellow named Lysanias, but he was a ruler in Chalcis half a century before this. Luke didn't know what he was talking about. But then an inscription was dug up near Damascus that confirmed Luke's account and showed there was this character, Lysanias, after all. Acts 17 and verse 6, one of those proper titles for the regional and local officials in Thessalonica, they were called Polytarchs. And for years there was no evidence of that term in any ancient Roman document that term was used of the city officials in Thessalonica. And for years, again, the skeptic said, you see, Luke didn't know what he was talking about. That term was used later. And so this is showing when Luke was actually written. But then, of course, later on, an arch was discovered in an archaeological expedition that showed that this title did match the first century. Luke was right in that use as well. In John 5, the Pool of Bethesda that you're familiar with the five porticos, the five roof colonnades, no such pool had been found for a long time. And then in 1956, some 40 foot below what is ground level, if I understand correctly, it was discovered with its five porches. And again, you could go down a list like this for a very long time, looking at all the things the skeptics said must be wrong because there's no evidence for it until there was evidence for it. And this sort of thing could go on forever. Another one that's more of a recent thing, as recently as 1997, a fellow by the name of Frank Zindler, in an article titled "Where Jesus Never Walked," published in the American Atheist magazine, sounds like a nice read, huh? Said at the turn of the era, there was no place called Nazareth. And we do not know when the place now called by that name became so identified. Nazareth was as mythical as the Mary, Joseph, and Jesus family that was supposed to have lived there. In a sense, I guess you could say he's completely right. It is just as mythical as they were, which is to say, not at all. But he's saying Nazareth was mythical. Nazareth did not exist at the turn of the first century. Well, excavations as recently as 2009 by the Jewish Antiquities Authority, a group that has no vested interest whatsoever in proving Jesus' hometown, have clearly identified the Nazareth in the first century. I mean, this kind of thing just goes on and on and on everywhere. They can't just prove it 100%. Well, it must be wrong. You may have heard at times people allege that Christians argue for a God of the gaps, which is to say that anywhere science can't explain something, that must be where God fits in. And that's a really poor way of arguing from a Christian perspective. I don't like that kind of argument, and sometimes we do slip into that, although I don't think it's as often as they allege. But I bring that up because what I would suggest is what skeptics are doing is they're arguing a fraud of the gaps, which is to say that the Bible is wrong where and only where it can't be corroborated by extra-biblical history or archaeology. Everywhere the Bible intersects with these other things, the Bible is shown to be right over and over and over and over again. Yet they still say it must be wrong somewhere. Well, where is that place where it must be wrong? Well, it's wrong in that place where we have no information at all. Really? That's the strength of your argument? That it's wrong only in those places where we can't know one way or the other? It's right everywhere else, but it's wrong in those places? That's absurd. That's the height of absurdity. That probably takes more faith than saying, hey, look at all the places that's right. It must be right in these other places as well. Well, let me point to a couple of other things that suggest their accuracy, or in this first case, at least their historicity. And it's an argument that I was not familiar with until just a couple of years ago. It's an argument called undesigned coincidences. And it's rooted in the fact that the Gospels are different accounts of the same stories that tell the stories in different ways. And all of them emphasize and often include or exclude different details of these stories. And very often, the way that the different accounts of the stories interlock with one another, and something that is not an intentional way of interlocking, shows that these are historical narratives. It's the kind of thing that is extremely unlikely, if not impossible, if it's just one copying the other one down. It's highly improbable if they're just making the whole thing up. Really, it's impossible if they're just making it up. If each of them is writing their own independent fiction, it's not the sort of thing that's going to happen at all. I mean, when was the last time you were reading Moby Dick and you got to a part of Moby Dick you didn't understand, and so you said, let me see, how am I going to figure this out? Well, let me go read A Farewell to Arms, and that's going to help me understand this passage in Moby Dick. Well, it doesn't make any sense at all to do that, because they're different fictions and different worlds. That's not the way fiction works. But it is the way that history works. And so one account will mention a detail in passing that answers a question that is raised by another gospel, and they fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Now, I know the first time you hear that, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and so that's fine. Let me give you some examples, and you'll see how it works, how these stories all interlock together that show a clear mark of history. I've got a friend that has like an hour-long talk on this where he goes through, I think, a dozen different examples and then refers his listeners to another book that talks about even more. I'm not going to do that to you. I'll just go through five or six pretty quickly just to let you see the way that this basically works. In Matthew chapter 26, go ahead and turn there if you would. We'll at least read a little bit out of the Bible tonight. Matthew chapter 26, we find Jesus on his way to the cross. Matthew chapter 26 and verses 67 and 68, it says, "Then they spit in his face and struck him, and they slapped him, saying, Prophesy to us, you Christ, who is it that struck you?" And so they have Jesus, they're spitting in his face, and they're saying, well, you know, if you're this Christ, if you're this great prophet, why don't you tell us who it is that hit you? Now, tell me, why didn't Jesus just look across at the person and say, well, Bob, it's you. It's pretty obvious. You're the one that hit me. Why doesn't he do that? You can talk. Go ahead. Anybody know why? He's blindfolded. You know how you know that detail? Not from reading Matthew. That detail is given nowhere in Matthew at all. If you're just reading Matthew, if you're just reading it for the first time, you might find yourself scratching your head going, well, why is this the case? Why doesn't he just know who it is? But when you turn to Luke's account in Luke chapter 22 in verses 63 and 64, you find this very detail given. Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, Prophesy, who is it that struck you? And so you see the way these two stories interlock with one another. One fills in the detail that the other one leaves out. Now, if that just happens once, if this is the only place in the entire New Testament where this happens, you shrug your shoulders and you say, Matthew must have left something out. But what you find is this very sort of thing happens over and over and over again, that they fill in the details that the other one leaves out, interlocking with one another. One explains the other, which again, what I suggest to you is that this shows that there is a single historical event that stands behind all of it. Because if they're just making it up on their own, it wouldn't have happened this way. If they're just copying from each other, if they just got together and decided, this is the story we're going to tell, it wouldn't have happened this way. The only way it happens like this is if they're all independently recording the same history. That's how this kind of thing happens. And so in Matthew chapter 8, for example, we find people waiting to be healed. And this is an interesting one as well. Matthew chapter 8, verses 14 through 16. This is at Peter's mother-in-law's house. When Jesus entered Peter's house, he touched his mother-in-law, lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve them. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. And so Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law, and then that evening, people bring Jesus their sick so they may be healed. Well, why is it if they knew that Jesus was there and they knew that Jesus could heal people and there were people who needed to be healed and they believed that Jesus could do it, why did they wait until evening to bring the sick people to Jesus? Why didn't they just do it right then when Jesus got to town? You know, maybe give them 15 minutes with Peter's family to, you know, catch up or whatever and then come. Why did they wait till evening? Anyone know? Sabbath day. In Mark chapter 1, you find the answer to this. Mark chapter 1 and verse 21, they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And so you have Sabbath is the setup here, and then down in verse 29, immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. He heals Peter's mother-in-law. And then verse 32, that evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons. And so again, Matthew leaves out the detail of why it was that Jesus doesn't immediately heal them. The people don't want to bring Jesus their sick on the Sabbath day, probably having to do with the Pharisaic Sabbath laws and not wanting to violate those things. And so you have Luke explaining Matthew in the first example, Mark explaining Matthew in the second example. We'll find next that Mark explains Luke as well. And the Transfiguration, the story you're very well familiar with, I'm sure also. I won't take the time to read the whole thing. But notice a couple of the details in particular. In Luke chapter 9, in verse 29, as he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke about his departure. And then down verse 33, Peter says to Jesus, Master, it's good that we are here. Let us make three tents, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. And after these, as he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid. As they entered the cloud, a voice came out of the cloud saying, "This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him." So Jesus' face is altered. His clothes become dazzling white. Moses and Elijah appear in glory and they speak with him about his departure. A voice comes out of heaven and says, "This is my son." And in verse 36, when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone and they kept silent and told no one. What sense does that make at all? I mean, this is the most momentous moment in their lives. They see Jesus in his glory. They see Moses and Elijah in their glory. A voice from heaven speaks to them, and they don't tell anyone about it. I mean, if you're like me, you find a good deal at a restaurant and you tell the world, right? They've seen Jesus transfigured, and they tell no one. What kind of sense does that make? Well, it makes sense if you know the rest of the story, which is what's told in Mark. And that is in Mark chapter 9 and verse 9 that Jesus tells them to keep silent about this until after his resurrection. Probably the most frequently disobeyed command in the gospel is Jesus telling people not to talk about something. Here's one time it's obeyed. They keep silent about this until after the resurrection. And so Mark explains Luke's account as well. Well, before we get to the next one, I want to do a little thinking exercise with you. Let's say that we are like these terrible, evil gospel authors who are making up all these false stories about Jesus. Again, that's what the skeptics want us to believe, right? So we're going to make up a miracle story. And the miracle story is going to begin with Jesus asking one of his disciples a question, and it's going to involve money and food. So if you're making up a miracle story where Jesus asks his disciples a question about money and food, who do you ask?
Somebody.
Judas. Why Judas? He has the money bag, okay? Who else? Anybody? Anyone have a different idea? When I've asked this in different places, Greg, you can't answer, you know. Tom, you can't answer, you know, too. At least I presume you know. People will say Matthew from time to time because Matthew's a money guy as well, so maybe he would know something about that. People have suggested Peter because he's the leader of the apostles. That makes sense. You know, he's kind of the head of the group, so he might be one that Jesus would ask a question about. Or John has been suggested before as well because John and Jesus have this very close relationship. And so maybe John is the one that he would ask. But what you find is in John chapter 6 and verse 5, someone completely different is asked. John chapter 6 and verse 5, flip over there if you will. This is the story of the feeding of the 5,000. He's there at the beginning in John's account. He speaks up one more time later on, and that's basically it. You don't know anything about Philip. He's, nothing against him personally. I don't know the guy, but he's something of a wallflower in the gospel stories. He's not a lead character. You don't know. You just wouldn't pick Philip. Why does Jesus ask Philip this question of all things? Well, as you compare the accounts, again, you find something of an answer to this. What you find in Luke chapter 9 in verses 10 and 11, here Philip is not mentioned specifically, but what you find is that the setting of this miracle is Bethsaida. And that's important because when you get to John chapter 12, later on, and you have this group of Gentiles who want to see Jesus, in John chapter 12 and in verse 21, Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip, let me start in verse 21, actually, not verse 22. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Why did Jesus ask Philip, "Where are we to buy this food?" Because it's Philip's hometown is where this is happening. It'd be like, you know, I'm from the Gainesville area. It's been a while since I lived there. But if you were going to that area and you said, "Hey, I'm going up to Gainesville. Where would be a good place to eat?" You know, that would make more sense than, you know, going to Tom and asking him. Or if you were going to Muncie, Indiana, and you want to know a good place to stay, don't ask me, ask Tom. It makes sense to ask the person who's from that area. Now, John's account makes it clear that he's saying this to test them. But still, it makes sense to test them with one who knows the area best. Where can we buy bread for all these people here in little podunk Bethsaida? And the answer is obvious. Nowhere. There's nothing we can do to feed all of these people here in Bethsaida, but who knows that best? Philip does. And so Jesus asks Philip. But Luke doesn't mention Philip. John doesn't mention Bethsaida. And neither one of them puts it together until later on when John mentions that Philip is from Bethsaida. But only by piecing those different elements together can we understand why Jesus addresses Philip in John chapter 6. One more, and then I'll wrap this part of it up. We've got one more thing to talk about after that. In John chapter 21, Jesus, as he is restoring Peter, asking him if he loves him the three times, part of what pains Peter so much is that he asks him three times, just like Jesus, or he denied Jesus three times. I think the other part of what pains Peter so much about this is Jesus asks, "Do you love me more than these?" And that's been interpreted in a couple of different ways. People have understood it to talk about, you know, the boats and the fishing equipment. People think that, you know, they've gone back to their life of fishing immediately at this point, and do you love me more than your old life? I would suggest that what Jesus is asking him is, "Do you love me more than the other disciples love me?" Which would be a really shocking thing for Jesus to say. I mean, why would Jesus ever seek to compare one disciple's love for him with another disciple's love for him? And that's a difficult interpretation of the text because that's not at all the sort of thing you would expect Jesus to do. Except when you understand that what Jesus is doing is restoring Peter and going back and asking the question three times because he denied Jesus three times. You remember also as you go back in the story that Peter had said in Mark chapter 14 and in Matthew's account as well, "Even if they all forsake you, Lord, I never will." Peter had made this very boast. Peter had come right out and said, "I love you more than they do, Jesus." But you don't understand that just from John's account unless you understand the whole story from Matthew and Mark as well. So Mark explains John explains Luke, which explains John, Mark explains Luke, and on down the line we could go until we have arrows drawing back and forth between every single gospel account. And again, the point is fiction does not work like this. Mythology does not work like this. Legend does not work like this. The only thing that acts this way are independent narratives of a historical account. This is history that we have in the New Testament. Well, let me give you one other newish sort of line of evidence. This is fairly frequent as well that this has been brought up, and that's evidence that comes from names. Again, the skeptical perspective is that none of the Gospels were written in Palestine in the first century. Conservatives as well, believers pretty much agree that they weren't written in Palestine, although they would obviously argue by the date, about the date. But if you're a skeptic, it's written in another country like 100 years later is when these Gospels were written. And so the question is, how accurate are they if they're doing this? They're in another place, another culture, speaking maybe another language even. How accurate are they? Well, if you've never visited a place, how do you write about it intelligently? Well, the answer for us is pretty easy. You get on the internet, right? You look up as much as you can about that place from 100 years ago, and you try to write about it as intelligently as possible. But what you find is that you probably still miss some of the details. You probably still get some of it wrong because you're not actually living in that culture. And all the research in the world you can do, you're still going to miss some stuff along the way. Even in the information age, if you've not actually been to a place and lived in it, in its culture, it is extremely difficult to write about it accurately if you're just making stuff up. Well, this is one of the things that the gospel authors get extremely right, and that is names of people and names of places. And this is something that I had never in my life would have considered if I hadn't had seen this evidence presented, and that is the frequency of names. What is the most popular name in first century Jewish Palestine? And they have now the ability to look at like the top 100 or more names. And what you find is that in the Gospels, they match up pretty close to identical with first century Jewish Palestine, both in men's names and women's names. So imagine with me that you're trying to write a story. You're trying to foist it off as fact, as history, even though it's not. And the story that you're writing is going to be set in France 100 years ago. How many names can you get right in your story about France? I mean, you probably put Jacques in there somewhere. Pierre, probably you'd fit in there. Beyond that, I mean, do you have any clue what people were named in France 100 years ago? How frequently they were named by those things? Could you get it right in the right proportion? That, you know, if 50% of all of the people in France were named either Jacques or Pierre, 50% of the males in your story would have that name. See, that's what the gospel writers do. A study that was based on 3,000 first century Jewish names shows that Jews were named different things in different places. Jews in Palestine didn't have the same names as Jews in Egypt. And the gospels were written in a different place from Palestine, skeptics say 100 years later. But what you find is that the names are right all the way down. The top two men's names in first century Palestine were Simon and Judas. They accounted for 15.6% of all males were named either Simon or Judas in first century Palestine. In the Gospels and Acts, 18% of all males have one or the other of those names. The top nine names, as the data sample gets bigger, the more accurate it is. The top nine names in Israel and in Palestine was 41.5%. 41.5% of all males were named one of these nine things. Those same nine names in the Gospels account for 40%, 40.3% of all males. And the women line up pretty closely as well. There's a little bit of a bigger gap because there were fewer women's names in general and fewer women in the Gospel stories, but they still are less than 10% difference all the way down. So they get the right names, they get them in the right proportions, and they have the right features of names as well. And what I mean by that is they interact with names in the right way. The number one name in first century Judea was Simon. What happens if you go out on the street and say, Simon? How many heads turn your way, right? Well, how do you make a distinction? Well, you know, if it's our culture, we say first name, last name, or maybe first name, middle name, last name. But they don't have that in first century Palestine. So how do they make a distinction between all the Simons? Well, you've got Simon who is called Peter. You've got Simon the Zealot. You've got Simon the Tanner. You've got Simon of Cyrene. You've got Simon the Leper. What about all the Judases? Well, you've got all the different Judases and their specific distinctions as well. All the Marys, you've got Mary Magdalene, and Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and Mary the mother of Jesus. What you find is the names that have this kind of clarification are invariably names in the top part of the chart. The names that don't have the clarification are names that are in the bottom part of the chart. Somehow, these fraudulent gospel authors, 100 years later, writing in a different place, not only got all the names right, but also got them right to the point that they knew which names to clarify and which names not to clarify. That is just the most amazing coincidence in the world, that somehow they pulled that off in the age before Wikipedia. Anyone here ever have a hard time remembering someone's name? You know their face. You know the face of their wife. You can see their three kids running around. You could tell like 15 different stories about them, maybe from the time they stayed like a month at your house. But for some reason, you just can't get their name. Anyone like that? Maybe not to that extreme, but have a hard time with names. But the reason that is because there's no real logical connection between a person and their name. There's no reason that someone should be called what they're called, logically speaking. That's just what they're called. That's the hard part. Stories are easy to remember. You could tell those 15 stories about them because stories are easy. Names are hard. So if the Gospels have correctly gotten the detail that's the hardest thing to remember, how much confidence should that give us in the part of the story that's easier to remember? It's not only people's names that they get right, they get place names right as well. How well do you know the geography outside of Florida or outside of the U.S.? Places, you know, how many places are there that you never heard of? Let's go back to our story about France that we're writing from 100 years ago. How many cities can you fit into your story? Paris? That's about the extent of it for me. I mean, Versailles, maybe. You could probably squeeze out 3 or 4, maybe 5 or 6 if you know Europe pretty well. And then can you get the local rulers in all of those places right as well? Maybe you could come up with 5 or 6. What about the geography? Do you know which cities you go up into and which cities you go down into? Or down into? Do you know what kinds of plants are in each place? Do you know about the burial customs in the different cities? Well, the Gospels name 23 different cities and villages. Jerusalem, Nazareth, Capernaum, Bethany, Bethlehem, Bethsaida, Jericho, Sidon, Tyre, Arimathea, Bethphage, Nain, go on and on. Things that, again, skeptics doubted the existence of for years. The Gospels get them right. They put them in the right place. They know the geography of them. They know the climate of them. They know how long it takes to get from one to the other. You know why it is that Zacchaeus climbs a sycamore tree in Jericho? Well, because he's a wee little man. You know that part. But why is it a sycamore tree that he climbs? Because there are sycamore trees in Jericho. They know the details to that level. If you go down to a Barnes & Noble and you walk through their religious section, undoubtedly you'll find a book called like The Lost Gospels or The Hidden Gospels or something like that. And it's this marketing ploy to make you believe that there are all these other documents that have been suppressed by the church and hidden from you that tell the true story. In fact, the Da Vinci Code basically comes right out and says that that's the case about these documents. These are the ones that tell the true story. Well, the data in these lost gospels is pretty pitiful. As a corpus, all of them put together, they list 2 city names. 2. Jerusalem and Nazareth. In the Gospel of Philip, the only one that mentions Nazareth thinks that it's Jesus' middle name. So all of them together get 1 city right. It's Jerusalem. Everybody knows. That's like me writing my story about France and getting Paris right. It doesn't mean a thing. Everyone knows that Paris is right. the Gospels get these 23 cities right. They know the geography. They know the climate. They know the travel time. They know the botany of all things. And again, what would the skeptic have you believe? That these other little documents, these are evidence against the Gospels. The Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas. These are evidence against the Gospels. They tell the real story. No, they're not evidence against the Gospels. They're evidence for the Gospels. Because they show you very clearly what a fraudulent Gospel looks like. It's something that's made up by someone 100 years later that has no familiarity whatsoever with the land or the culture. They get the names wrong. They get the cities wrong. They don't know a thing. By comparison, to them, the Gospels are incredible history. By comparison to the greatest historical work that we could find, the Gospels are incredible history. We have every reason to be confident in the documents that we have. Minute details that are peripheral to the story are right. Things like titles of various people, geographic locations, people's names, all of these little things that have nothing to do with it, really. All of that is right. If all of that is right, why should we believe the story is wrong? Everywhere that we can check it against history, against archaeology, it is right. Everywhere. And so we're expected to believe that it's wrong in those places where we can't check it? That's ridiculous. And so what we have, again, in these Gospels is an incredibly historically reliable account of this man Jesus. That even if you're talking to your skeptical neighbor, your friend, and you're trying to convince him, and he says, "Well, I just don't believe in inspiration." Well, that's fine. I mean, maybe you'll come to believe in that in time, but you don't have to believe in inspiration to trust the story. Because if the Gospels aren't historical, nothing is historical. We have every reason to believe that what they tell us about Jesus is true. And so the legend option is off the table. And we're brought back to where we began, that Jesus is either Lord or liar or lunatic. And so we either demonize him as a liar, we laugh at him as a lunatic, or we fall down and worship him as Lord. And we offer this opportunity for you, if you have never come to Jesus, to do that tonight. To come to him as Lord, making him not only the Lord of the universe, but the Lord of your life. For that is a choice that you have to make now. Deny yourself, take up a cross, and follow him. Burying your old man in baptism and raising to walk in a new life. Or if there's any other way that we can help you this evening, won't you come?